vision.
Ah, you know.
But there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole out in the sun, where you left a row half done. You claim that hoeing ain't no fun.
But I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing by a shady, weighty pool.
Shangri-La. Really la.
I'm wishing I could be that kind of fool.
Shall I twist your arm?
Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. It's very likely that our topic for tonight has never before been the main topic for this program. But with the changing seasons, it's totally appropriate. And no, it's not baseball. That'll come in a few weeks. It's fishing. And more specifically, it's fly fishing. All of this leading up to an event coming to SteelSacks on March 28th and 29th called the Fly Fishing Film Tour. I'm Steve Aronson, and joining me tonight at the WDIY microphones are Eric Rosick, an award-winning president of the Monocacy chapter of an organization called Trout Unlimited, and treasurer and board member Dr. Edwin S. Hart. Eric, you were born up in Syracuse, the Syracuse area, and you started fishing on the St. Lawrence River and around some lakes maybe in the area. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. Where'd you go to school? And a little bit more about that award that we talked about.
Sure. First, I'm originally from the Syracuse area, and I currently reside in Bethlehem. Early on, I was introduced to fishing by my grandfather, and then luckily for me, some friends of ours had a camp up on the St. Lawrence River, and we would go up there quite a few weekends during the summer and go fishing for panfish, bass, pike, basically whatever I could catch. And as my passion grew, I started fishing more around the Syracuse area whenever I got the chance. In the canal system, the barge canal system, Oneida Lake, Seneca River, places like whatever was close to home that I could get to. I am an award-winning president, although I don't like to talk about it too much. But just recently, this past fall, I was awarded the Volunteer of the Year for the Pennsylvania State Trout Unlimited.
Well, congratulations for that, and we're glad to have you in the Lehigh Valley now. And Dr. Hart, you're from Philadelphia, you graduated from Temple University, and you got started fishing in an unusual way.
Yeah, back in my childhood, my grandfather, Stanley Wood, saw to it that I developed this addiction to fishing. And although it wasn't fly fishing at first, it was with dough balls and catching sunnies and panfish. It went on to, other pursuits. Trout fishing was something that was hard to do in the Philadelphia area, and a good friend of mine, Jim Ward, and I would venture off to the Delaware County streams and try our hand at fishing. And I can recall we did very poorly and wound up going to a catch and take home type venue where we took our fish home. I became a little more sophisticated and developed my skills and have taken a love to fly fishing over the last 25 years or so.
I should have mentioned also that you are a prominent podiatrist in the Lehigh Valley. And I also want to ask you this question. I've heard rumors that you actually would go fishing in a mud puddle if that were possible.
It's true. I'll saltwater fish. I'll fish in a mud puddle. I'll fish anywhere, anytime. Some patients even accuse me of being late for work because I've been out fishing. Some have even seen me fishing in the Monocacy when they're on the way to the office. It's hard to explain sometimes.
All right. Well, we'll be vigilant and see if we can find you next time we're heading up to Eastern Avenue. We're going to make this as informal as possible. Is it okay if I call you Doc? Doc?
You can call me whatever you want, just not late for dinner.
Well, that'll come a little later tonight. And Eric, okay.
Eric it is.
When I first came here and started doing programs like this, it was always Mr. and Ms. and so forth. And I find that kind of gets in the way of having This is not really an interview. This is a conversation, and I want to make that's how I want this to continue to be, just a conversation. So among the topics we're going to talk about tonight will be the work done by the national, state, and local chapters of Trout Unlimited, focusing both on the national level and focusing on the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited, and related organizations and agencies. And what this is all culminating in is the event coming to Steel Stacks on March 28th and 29th, the Flying Fishing Film Tour. But before we even talk about that and even the organizations that we're going to be discussing, let's talk about fly fishing itself. I have a quote here from author Isaac Walton, and he called fly fishing the contemplative man's recreation. I'd like you both to kind of comment on that.
Go ahead, Eric.
I'd be happy to. I've read that quote before, and I believe what Walton was going for was the fact that when you're fly fishing, it often takes a considerable amount of observation to be able to fool your quarry into eating something that's constructed with fur and feathers and has a hook in it. But more than just that, I believe that being on a stream and being immersed in nature sort of lends itself to being more in tune with, you know, your thoughts and what's going on around you.
I think it brings us to a point where you give up thinking about anything else but what you're trying to do, and that's to catch a fish. Thoreau said that often the fisherman doesn't really know what the reason is that he really goes into the wilds to fish, and not sure that it's always fish that he seeks. It's relaxation, it's observation, it's thinking about what that fish that your quarry may want, but it's also being absorbed in nature and your surroundings.
In terms of the most common prey for fly fishermen, what are they in general? What are they, and then specifically, what are they like in the Lehigh Valley?
Well, in the Lehigh Valley, let's talk locally. We have a wild trout population, wild brown trout, that live in the Monocacy. There's also some rainbow trout there that are stocked at different times of the year. And that's the main quarry in this area. But you can fish for a number of species across the state by fly fishing methods or any method. But you have in the Susquehanna River a big smallmouth bass population. The same thing in the Lehigh River. You can fish for them by fly fishing techniques. And Eric's a saltwater fisherman. You can go out to the ocean and fish for stripers.
Absolutely. Saltwater fly fishing is something that's actually gaining in popularity quite a bit. And I've been involved in saltwater fly fishing for probably the last 15 or so years. And I've caught everything from striped bass to fluke or flounder, depending on if you're from Jersey or South or not. Redfish. I've caught quite a few different saltwater species, snook down in Florida. People pursue tarpon on the fly rod, and everything up all the way up to blue marlin and, you know, bluefin tuna. All those species are pursued with the fly rod. It's really more of just a tool and a preference for a way to fish than it is necessarily targeted at a specific fish.
We'll get to the way to fish in a second. Did I hear anybody say salmon here for the Lehigh Valley?
No salmon here in the valley.
No salmon here, but you can go up to the Lake Erie tributaries, and there's salmon and there's steelhead and fish that migrate in and out of the Great Lakes.
Are there particular characteristics of fish that fly fishermen go after that might be distinguished from other fish? Is it a particular kind of fish or characteristics of a certain fish that make them more appropriate for fly fishing than the other kind? I want to talk about the other kind in a second, but
my personal experience is I could be out in Montana with my guide Russell Parks, and we could be fishing for brown trout or rising trout, or we could be nymphing, and all of a sudden we'll catch a Montana whitefish, which we really didn't target, but they just happen to be looking for something to eat at the same time. So I think we try to target the trout species when we're out in this area or out west, but sometimes you're going to catch something that you weren't expecting.
You mentioned okay. So that question's been answered. Let me. You mentioned nymphing. I want to get now. I remember. You see, my mind sometimes goes a little blank. But you mentioned nymphing. As long as you mentioned it, why don't you tell us what nymphing is?
Well, nymphing is fishing for your quarry under the surface, and most of the time, nymphing is probably more successful than the dry fly fishing because the fish are submerged and eating off the bottom, and you have a higher likelihood of probably catching fish all the time with nymphing techniques. And there are some fishermen that are pure nymph fishermen. I like to catch fish on dry flies where I see the fish come up and just take that fly off the surface or maybe ignore the fly and then a second later come up and just eat it because he decided it's what he wanted. And that's excitement for me. How about you, Eric? What do you think about nymphing?
So that happens to me at a salad bar every now and
then. Does it?
Sorry, Eric.
Yeah, no problem. I think a lot of times people sort of associate fly fishing with a very specific type of fly fishing, which is using a dry fly, a fly that floats on the surface of the water. A lot of times that's what you'll see in popular movies and things of that nature. But fly fishing actually, as a technique, can be used to cover the entire water column. When people talk about using nymphs, what they're talking about is imitating the larval form of the food items that trout eat. And most of those live on, near, or in the bottom. And when we're using a nymph, we're trying to present that particular fly on or as close to the bottom as we can, as opposed to using a dry fly, which would float on top.
Let me tell you all I know about fishing. And when I was growing up, I went fishing with my brothers. We went in a motorboat to a spot, City Island, New York, and we'd bait the hook, drop the fishing line straight down, and if we're lucky, in a few minutes, the end of the rod would start to bend, and we knew we caught something, and we'd reel it in. It was very simple, and successful in some ways. I myself have caught flounders and porgies, and we also used to go fishing in a creek in the Bronx. We used bread as a bait and caught carp. But that's all I know. It's straight down, and it was nothing complicated about it. Very simple, and I guess that's what we would call bait fishing.
Right. You know what? I think fishing is an evolution. You know, you find what it is you like. Eric and I seems like we have similar backgrounds. We started as bait fishermen, right?
Yep,
absolutely. And we moved along a progression, a continuum. You know, when I go in the ocean and fish, when I get the opportunity, we use bait. I don't really fly fish in the ocean. I'd like to learn how. I'm not that proficient yet. It's something that I strive to, but over time and over our experience level, we have progressed to different things. I was a spin fisherman, and I'll still spin fish in certain instances. But the thing that's really got my interest these days is fly fishing, and that's where I've evolved to.
Okay, now we're going to come to the crux of the matter. The difference between fly fishing and spin and bait fishing. I think many of our listeners probably have done a very simple kind of fishing like I did, but there is somewhat of a difference. And what does that entail?
Well, we can drown worms. I've got friends who love to fish with minnows, and they're using the bait that imitates the bait that the fish are eating under the surface. And whether you're fishing with a minnow or a lure, a Rapala, you're throwing that bait or lure out into the water, and the weight of the bait and the lure take the line out to the desired location.
And that's spin fishing or bait fishing, or
whatever. In fly fishing, it's a little different because the line is what has the weight, and the fly line is matched to the rod and the reel. At the end of the fly line, there's a leader, and then there's a thin piece of material called tippet, which is gauged to the size of the fly that you're casting. And the idea in a dry fly is for that fly to land above the fish, a distance above him so that, or her, it could be a female fish, right?
I suppose we wouldn't discriminate.
And we don't discriminate as far as male or female fish. We just want to catch fish.
It seems like whenever we're referring to a creature, we always say him. I mean,
yeah.
It just seems to be the idiom of the realm. But
yeah.
I'm sorry.
But anyway, we want that fly to sit on the surface and just drift over it, and hopefully that fish is looking up, and he's hungry, and then he eats it. But that fly is delivered by the weight of the line and the action of the fly rod.
Right. That's largely the big difference between the two styles of fishing, if you will. In that fly fishing uses the weight of the line to deliver something that's almost weightless or very, very small. And in other situations, if you're using traditional spin tackle, the weight at the end of the line is used to, like Doc said, pull the line off the reel, and that brings the line with it. That's really the main difference.
In reading up a little bit on this, one of the words I saw was target, delivery of a lure to a target, and you just explained the two different ways that the lure gets to the target. My question is, what is the target? Is it a fish that you see out there? Is it an area where you know that is known to harbor fish? What is the target we're talking about?
Yes,
all of those things. And the reason is, again, because I like to see the fish eat on the surface, I'm sometimes listening to the water, and you'll hear the fish gulp, or you'll see the fish leave a ring on the surface. And I'm figuring that's where a fish is living, and I want my fly to drift over that fish. And I'm going to throw that fly upstream or cross stream. And try to get the fish to eat it. If I'm fishing with a streamer, I'm fishing under the surface and imitating maybe a minnow or some sort of sculpin that we're trying to have pass in front of the fish and have him be triggered to eat that.
Right. So your target might be an actual fish that you see sometimes, especially like this past summer when we had very little rain. The streams were very clear. You could actually see fish in the stream. You could target them specifically. You might be targeting something in the stream, a rock, a tree branch hanging in the stream, a place where different types of currents come together. So I wasn't really trying to be, cheeky when I said yes, but the answer is yes. Depending on the situation, you may actually see the fish and you could target the fish that way, and you may not see the fish. You may be targeting likely spots where the fish live.
If I were going to become a fly fisherman as a beginner, what would you tell me to buy?
I think you can get started for under $100. I think one of the myths, can we break this myth?
We'll
try. To be a fly fisherman, you got to spend a lot of money. You don't really have to. My first rod was an L.L. Bean rod, and it was a kit that was, $89, and it even came with flies.
Yeah,
I still have some of those flies. I haven't lost them. The rod I broke in the car, I think I shut the door on it. But you don't have to spend a lot of money. And I think the appearance sometimes is that it's equipment intense. There's little gadgets for tying flies, and what happens is, as you get into the sport, and because it's an addiction, as you get into the sport, you want more stuff.
Yeah, because
you don't have to start with a lot of stuff.
You never know what the best stuff could be, so you got to have all of it.
And that stuff's always changing.
Right. To maybe answer your question, not more specifically, but it partly depends on the type of fish that you're pursuing. So the tackle that you would use for, say, saltwater, for, and I'll go real extreme, for a marlin, you know, a 1,500-pound marlin in the Gulf of Mexico would be significantly different than a 9-inch brown trout on the Monocacy Creek. The way fly rods and lines and tackle are rated are partly by what's called the line weight. And as Doc Hart said before, those things are usually matched. So if you're looking in a catalog or in a store, you might see a fly line that says 5 weight. Well, there will also be a rod that is marked 5 weight. And there will be a reel that is marked 5 weight. And those things are, at least relatively speaking, designed to work together. We could have a long discussion about the different weights and what they're appropriate for, but suffice it to say, the smaller the weight of the line, which is quite specifically the weight of the line, the smaller your quarry would be, your target would be, and the larger the number, the larger your quarry would be.
You know what? We haven't even spoken about what are flies yet, but before we do that, I'm going to take a short break and get back. I'm here. I'm Steve Aronson. I'm here with Dr. Edwin Hart and Eric Brozik from the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited, and we're going to be talking flies after this message.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
I'm fishing.
Ah, you know.
Well, there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole out in the sun.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're talking fly fishing tonight. All of it culminating in talking about an event coming to Steel Stacks March 28th and 29th, the Fly Fishing Film Tour. But we'll be talking about that a little bit later. We've been discussing fly fishing, but now let's talk about the flies themselves. Have you ever made a fly?
I think I tied some yesterday.
I wish I was tying right now. Wintertime is usually a good time to tie flies for me. I'm kind of a novice at it, but I enjoy just trying to fool the fish. The funny thing is you tie something on a hook, and you say to yourself at the vise, which is what holds the hook when we tie, gee, I wonder if this will catch a fish. And it's really exciting, and it's what catches your interest in tying when you actually catch a fish with something that you tied.
Let me reintroduce our guests, by the way. This is Dr. Ed Hart and Eric Brozik from the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited. What does a fly look like?
Well, that is a good question. It can look like many things or nothing in particular. Most flies are tied with at least some sort of fur or feathers. Some synthetic materials too, like maybe some flash, similar to what you might put on your Christmas tree at Christmas time, some tinsel, or other synthetic materials that look like hair, but aren't really hair. So in short, it looks like fur and feathers lashed onto a hook.
And understand that what we're trying to do is we're trying to imitate the various stages of an insect's life, whether that be a caddis, which looks like a moth when it's an adult, or a mayfly, or a grasshopper, or a stonefly. We're trying to tie things onto the hook that imitates that at the various stages of its life. And the mayfly has a very short life. It's hatched. It goes off into the woods and has reproductive activities. And then it comes back to the water and dies after it lays its eggs. It's a short life. They don't even get to have a cigar.
It's a short life, but enjoyable.
But a happy one.
Yeah.
If you... Where do folks go in this area to they can buy flies, I guess, right?
Well, there's, you know,
that's a great question.
That's a good question, and the problem is that we don't have a real good fly shop like where you can go and get stuff.
No, well, the one that's most local is the Heritage Fly Shop over on
right
the Little
on
Lehigh.
Little Lehigh.
It used to be the Little Lehigh Fly Shop. It's literally on the banks of the Little Lehigh Creek over in Allentown, just downstream from the fish hatchery, if you're familiar with that area. I believe Dave Bittner is still running that, and that's an excellent example of a dedicated fly fishing shop, and they have literally hundreds of different flies you can purchase there. But this day and age, to be honest, the bulk of flies are purchased online.
And you know, you can go to L.L. Bean.
Yep.
Bean has a selection
Cabela's.
Of flies. You can go to Cabela's. The other thing that's interesting is, and I don't know if this is true, but it's a rumor, but I think it is true that there actually is a fly shop now in Easton. For fly tires, we can get our materials online. If you're a hunter, you can use fur from your quarry.
My wife loves it when my neighbors leave deer tails and turkey wings on our front porch.
That's nice, isn't it? I have a friend who's a bird hunter, and occasionally I'll get some pheasant tails, which are helpful in tying some of the nymph patterns. But ultimately, you either purchase your flies through a company like Orvis or Blue Fly or some online purveyor or a local store, or you learn to tie them and save a little money.
Yeah, right.
There is an economy of scale there. Because if you're like me, you're losing flies in trees and bushes, and they're snapping off.
Like golf balls.
Yeah, like
right.
golf balls. It's
exactly.
just, you know, $2 a fly, it's rough. But it's like my guide on the Upper Delaware, Jerry Haddon, will say to me, "Hey, I just tied that on. You lost it already? What happened?" So, you know, you have these things occurring, and it becomes more efficient to have the skill of tying flies.
You mentioned guides in a couple of times. So when you go fly fishing, you have somebody kind of holding your hand? Or
here's my – well, you know, in the early days, Jerry did hold my hand, I think. Cause
I believe
if
that.
He was here, he'd tell you I was a crappy fly fisherman. But I think that I've improved over time. To really experience on a river system or a place you've never fished before – I think it is good to take a guide because they know the conditions. They know what's hatching. They know for a good part of the time where the fish are located. And most of the time they bring a good lunch.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's a great way to cut out, you know, the downtime of learning a new place. So absolutely. If you're traveling somewhere, you know, a good guide, because it's their business, because they do it probably nearly every day, they're very plugged into exactly what's happening. And that can make a big difference, especially when you start talking about saltwater fishing. You know, trout are, especially here, you know, in the Lehigh Valley, the trout are in the stream. They're not going anywhere, per se, all too often. Sure, they move around in their system, but they're not coming and going too much. Places like in New Jersey, if you're fishing saltwater in New Jersey or in Florida or in the Bahamas, where fish have a lot of place to roam around and they're more migratory, having a guide who's plugged into exactly where the fish are can make all the difference in the world. Absolutely.
Right. I presume when you're talking lunch, you're not talking bologna sandwiches.
It depends.
Depends who your guide is. I've had in Montana. It depends who you're fishing with, but my guides that I've used out there, they usually bring really nice sandwiches and, you know, beverages, adult beverages and water. And on a hot day, you increase a thirst and you want to have something to eat and drink. But I think without a fishing guide, you can waste a lot of time. Especially when you're on new water. So it's always worthwhile.
One of the terms I saw as I read up a little bit on fly fishing was something called catch and release. Can you explain that to our listeners?
I think that's a philosophy that came from up in New York with a guy by the name of Lee Wolf. I think he was the guy who really originated it. If you look at some of the old pictures of folks out fishing, the big thing was to have a big, huge stringer of enormous fish, and maybe that was very manly to take and kill all these fish. But what happens is you limit what's left in the stream, and the philosophy behind catch and release is really like a conservation idea that we leave some fish behind to reproduce and to be there for the next time we're out and to be able to enjoy that resource over and over again.
Is that what you
sustainability, I guess.
Is that what you do most of the time? Or
I very rarely kill a fish. You know, I guess occasionally in early in the season, I will take maybe a rainbow if I catch it or a fish that's badly hooked. But for the most part, I'm a catch and release guy, even in the ocean.
I am also too, and I really have no problem with people keeping their limit of fish, you know, where it's legal to do so. For me, it's just, you know, like Doc said, it's more of a philosophy of having fish there for tomorrow to come back to. You know, I think anyone who's involved in fishing has seen the pictures, like Doc said, big stringers, big brag boards like they have of, you know, just tons and tons of fish dead on hooks. And it was prevalent across all types of fishing. I mean, I certainly have seen pictures of giant marlin, swordfish, even sharks, tarpon, all those things. And I think people started to realize over time that every time we kill one of these things, one of these big fish, it's a chance that we don't have those fish back in the system. So it really has become pretty prevalent in many types of fishing, not all. But you see billfish, sailfish, marlin rarely are killed anymore for you know, food or display or whatever. Almost 100% of billfish are released. Tarpon are rarely ever killed anymore. Big fish like in the St. Lawrence River, like muskies, rarely are killed anymore. And part of that has to do with technology. It's just easier to take a picture of it now and right. have that.
That's
have
your
that
brag.
As your, have that as your, you know, brag versus bringing it back to the dock. So, I mean, that has certainly has played a role in it.
So it's for the sport, mainly for the sport rather than for any other reason. And it's a high interest kind of sport right now. We're going to talk about Trout Unlimited. I just discovered today that in 1897 there was actually a fly fishing tournament in Madison Square Garden in New York.
I wasn't there. Honest, Steve, I wasn't there. Eric? I know I look like I could have been there, but I wasn't there.
Trout Unlimited and Monocacy Chapter. Let's start with the national numbers here. 150,000 members, 400 local chapters. Pennsylvania, there are 12,000 members and 50 local chapters. The interest is high in that sport. What else can you tell us about the national organization?
Sure. Trout Unlimited as a national organization is a conservation organization. Its mission is to conserve, protect, and restore the cold water resources of the United States. And when we're talking about cold water, we're talking about mainly trout and salmon and some other species too. But that's really the focus of Trout Unlimited. I think sometimes people do confuse Trout Unlimited with being a fly fishing organization. And part of the reason is that Trout Unlimited was started by fly fishermen, and the large majority of members are fly fishermen. So it does definitely cater to that segment of the angling population. But at its core, it is a conservation organization. It is not a fishing club. It's not a fly fishing club. It's not any of those things. And Trout Unlimited, at the national level, does a lot of work to try to influence decision makers on a national level and on a state level to protect our cold water resources. And that's really the main focus of the national organization. It's set up as what's called a grassroots organization. So it's really designed from the bottom up. Got people like myself and Dr. Hart and the members in our chapter, we're on the ground, boots on the ground, so to speak, in the field, you know, doing the work. And then it sort of trickles up from there.
And we're volunteers.
And we're all volunteers at the local level.
You mentioned the word angler.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy.
I've seen that word a lot growing up, and they're just thrown about. What does it mean? What does the term angler actually mean?
Well, in the pool hall, it's different, but in fishing, I think Shakespeare made a reference to angling in his work, but I think it comes out of the old English or maybe even in German. To angle is actually to bend metal. So we fish with a hook that has to be bent and then applied to a line, and we put bait on there. But I look at angling as something else when it comes to trout fishing, because these fish are not dumb. They are very smart, and they have good vision. They don't need glasses, but they can see you coming. So to angle, you have to get yourself in the right position above or below the fish so the fish can't see you, because they have really good eyesight underneath the water where they can see you approaching the side of the stream. So you got to be there at the right angle. That's another interpretation for me. But the real thing, I think, comes out of the old English for bending metal.
But it does sound like a bit of geometry here.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, that's certainly a part of it. Absolutely.
And physics. Fishing's physics.
One of the things I learned about from looking at information on Trout Unlimited, there are lawyers, there are policy experts, and there are scientists part of the mix there.
Absolutely. You know, from a national level, like I said, they do a lot of advocacy work in Washington, D.C., and then, you know, in state legislatures around the entire country. But the focus really tries to be on science-based arguments so that we can come from a position of not just a subjective, you know, point about, well, we would like to see this done, but it's from really a science-based background where we can say, this is why we think these things should be conserved or done this way. And that really strengthens your argument.
The activity is not only about the habitats itself, but things that affect the habitats. I noticed they even work on projects involving abandoned mines and shale gas.
Sure, there's actually programs here in Pennsylvania to monitor streams and look at the effects of oil exploration and is it having effect on water quality. In Pennsylvania, we have a lot of mining in West Virginia the same way, and some of these abandoned mines leach water that has pollutants in it and mine acid into the river systems. On the Lehigh River, there's the Luan Tunnel, I guess it's called, where one organization, not with Trout Unlimited, but a good organization, the Stocking Association, is doing some things on the Lehigh River to try and improve the quality of water and remediate this mine acid drainage. So, you know, it's a critical issue, because if you don't have clean water, you're not going to have the fishing and the quality of fishing that you want. I think that one of the other things to kind of spin off of Eric is, I think to use an educating organization, because there's a lot of opportunity to educate youth. There's a program called Trout in the Classroom that brings fry into the classroom and allows the students to raise these fish and ultimately release them on the local streams. There's the Rivers Conservation, which our local TU chapters support. My son was fortunate enough to receive a scholarship to go to the Rivers Conservation School down in Boiling Springs or on the Yellow Breaches. And I think it's responsible for why he has an interest in environmental studies and environmental science. So I think we have a chance to educate and shape the perspective of young people into conservation and why these streams are important and why we want to keep them in good conditions.
We're going to get to the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited, and also we're going to have to leave some time to talk about the event, the Fly Fishing Film Tour, coming to Steel Sacks at the end of the month. I'm Steve Aronson here with Dr. Ed Hart and Eric Brozik from the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited, and we're going to be back right after this message.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Fishing.
How are you know?
But there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
There's your hole.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Again, I'm Steve Aronson with Dr. Ed Hart and Eric Brozek, and we're talking fishing this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. We've been talking about conservation as well, and very active in the area of conservation is the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited. Tell us about that, Doc and Eric.
Sure. You know, locally, the Monocacy chapter and all the chapters in the Lehigh Valley, we're sort of lucky in that we have four Trout Unlimited chapters right here in the Lehigh Valley. We have the Monocacy chapter, the Hockendaqua chapter, the Little Lehigh chapter, and the Forks of the Delaware chapter. And all four chapters are very active in both education, conservation, and then in other activities, just, you know, community outreach. We, you know, very specifically to conservation, we do things like we just completed a small dam removal on Monocacy Creek this past summer. And that sort of frees up parts of the stream for the fish to be able to move back and forth. I mean, that's sort of a very simplistic view of what we did. The Forks of the Delaware chapter is actually looking into restoring about 2 miles of the creek in Easton there. The Hockendaqua chapter has done some in-stream projects up on the Hockendaqua Creek. And then in expanding upon that, not just what you would think of as conservation activities, but chapters like the Hockendaqua chapter are very active in a program called Project Healing Waters, which takes any veteran, disabled or not, and they literally take them fishing because it's a great distraction from your day-to-day life. You know, sort of as we've been talking about all along, you're so focused on trying to catch an organism with a brain the size of the pea and it's outsmarting you that you really have to, it really gets to you and you got to focus. It becomes an addiction and it sort of allows you to step away from maybe the other things that are going on in your life. Project Healing Waters is a fantastic program. The Hockendaqua chapter organizes at least one event every year, and the other chapters help out with that. I believe we've been involved with Casting for Recovery, which is a breast cancer survivor program similar to Project Healing Waters. We've done things like help out with Cub Scouts. Three local chapter members did a huge Cub Scout jamboree down in Hellertown this past fall, froze, sat outside all day and froze with Cub Scouts and talked to them about conservation, fish, showed them bugs from the stream, things like that. So those are some of the things that we do locally. And, you know, to sort of sum it all up, as far as what we're interested in is we're really interested in making sure that there's fish available, not only for ourselves, but for our children and our children's children. And what that means is figuring out a way to make sure that the water stays cold and clean. And that's really good for everybody, not just fishermen or fish.
I want to go back to Casting for Recovery for a second. You and I, Doc, spoke about that a bit yesterday.
Right. The whole deal with that is it's a organization that's supported by Trout Unlimited. It runs by itself. It's out of Vermont. And physicians became aware that the mechanics of fly fishing was beneficial physically for folks that had undergone, women who have undergone mastectomies and reconstructions. And there's a whole program. It takes place at Skytop. And there's a lottery where women apply to be part of this program. And there's support. There's many things that go on there. And one part of it is a day fly fishing where members of Trout Unlimited are there to mentor and help these breast cancer survivors to be successful on the stream. And I think that's the thing about any type of fishing is it gets your mind off what your situation is, and it gives you a different focus, and it's relaxing. But that'll take place again, and they have their own website, castingforrecovery.org, for any listener who's had a cancer, breast cancer, or is currently under treatment for that. And it'll be at Sky Top. I think it takes place in the fall. These programs are outreaches for Trout Unlimited to reach out into the community. And we're fortunate because we have a collaborative effort amongst the chapters of Trout Unlimited here in the Lehigh Valley to work together for a number of these things. Hawk and Dockwa also does a fly tying demonstration for youth and for adults to learn to tie flies during the winter. And I think that's another wonderful venue for folks who are interested in that. And Trout Unlimited is really looking to increase its membership in a broad sense, but also in a diverse sense. We're willing to and would like to have women members.
You anticipated by one of my questions. It's not just for fishermen, and it's not just for people who fish.
Right. It's, you know, if you have an interest in the sport or conservation, although we are a conservation organization, you can't help but learn about fishing by being a member, but you'll also find that you're pulled into the conservation aspects, as well as learning about destination trips and things of that nature.
How many members are there in the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited?
It's about 180, 185 members currently. We wish they'd all come to a meeting some night.
That would be fantastic.
We'd have to get more card table chairs.
Where are your meetings held?
We meet at the log cabin on 8th Avenue across from Nitschman School. We meet the last Tuesday of the month, the fourth Tuesday. Our meetings start at 7 o'clock, and we meet from September through May. Our May meeting usually is along the stream because there's a hatch of insects called the sulfurs, which we hope and pray will be there that night. And we try to fish for trout imitating the sulfurs. Anyone's welcome. You don't have to be a member of Trout Unlimited to come to our programs or to our meetings. We welcome the general public. Last month, we had a wonderful presentation about water conditions on the Monocacy and the Little Lehigh systems. Very, very educational from a biology professor from Moravian. What was his name?
Dr. Frank Cusick.
Yeah, it was an awesome program, and it brings a lot of people out to learn about that.
Is there anything unique about the Monocacy Creek itself? I saw a reference to limestone, for one thing, when I read it.
Absolutely.
Read about it. And also, it's been it's called a high-quality cold water fishery.
Yep, that's a DEP, Department of Environmental Protection designation. The way streams get classified can be rather cumbersome, but suffice it to say that there's usually some classification based on water quality, and then there's some protections that go along with that, and then there may or may not be, depending on where the stream is and how it's used, a fishing regulation associated with it. Those two things are not coupled together. You can have one without the other, but the Monocacy Creek, really the Lehigh Valley, as far as trout fishing goes, we're really sort of spoiled here in the Lehigh Valley in that we have amazing water quality in a very urban setting. We have the Monocacy, the Saucon, the Little Lehigh.
The Bushkill?
The Bushkill, the Hawk and Dockwa. The Monocacy itself is similar to both the Saucon and the Little Lehigh in that they are limestone streams. And basically what that means is that they're spring-fed. Water flows underground for some portion of time and comes up again in springs. And that spring water is, A, cold. It's pretty consistent all year. You'll
never see it freeze.
You'll almost never see the Monocacy freeze. I doubt it. It's almost never happened. It's the water is usually right around 50 degrees coming out of the spring.
Wow. I've also heard references or saw references to it being a trophy trout water and part of an adopted stream.
Sure.
Yeah, a certain section of the Monocacy Stream is earmarked as a trophy trout section. When you fish in there, you have to fish with artificial lures and flies. There's restrictions on what you can keep during the season, and then it's all catch and release. You can fish there throughout the year. There's no closed season. You just can't kill fish or take fish specifically during this time right now.
There's a minimum 14-inch fish that you can take in the trophy trout section, and it's only two fish per day. Contrast that with what's called the approved trout waters, which would be from Illick's Mill Dam down to the confluence of the Lehigh. And that's the part of the stream that's stocked by the state, where you can keep five fish per day, and I believe the minimum size is 7 inches. So that's the real difference. And no trout are stocked in the trophy trout section. Those are all wild fish. They live there year-round. They reproduce there. They make baby fish every year, and there's enough fish there to support recreational angling, which is fantastic.
Stocking trout just seems like... catching a stocked fish doesn't seem like fishing to me, but that's my unschooled opinion.
Well, I mean, certainly there's a lot of passion that goes behind that discussion. I think there's definitely a place for the stocking of fish. And in my estimation, and a lot of other people, it's to create an opportunity. Places where you don't have the opportunity to catch a fish, I think it's a fantastic program for the state to raise those fish, bring them in, and create a fishing opportunity. Do we need to have stocked fish everywhere? No. I'm not sure about that.
Well, you've clarified. Thank you for that. You clarified that a little bit. Well, we have some time left. What this is all leading up to, folks, is an event at Steel Sacks on March 28th and 29th called the Fly Fishing Film Tour. The first question I have about that is how did this is the third year?
It's the third year, yep. It started, 2 years ago or 3 years ago. Our chapter, Monocacy, was looking for a way we could find our own niche, so to speak, in the community. Other chapters are involved with fly tying, Project Healing Waters, et cetera. And we were looking for where could we bring information about fly fishing and engage the community. And we've partnered with Arts Quest.
How did that come about? That was going to be my question.
Well, really, I'm going to take the responsibility. At a board meeting, I said, do you think we could do this? I had heard about it in Montana. My guide out there, Russell Parks, put the idea in my head. And, I said, this is something we could do. And the board approved it cautiously because we were on the hook for some money. But it was successful. Last year we turned away people. We didn't have enough seats. This year we've gone to two nights. And ticket sales are brisk right now. And we're hoping to sell out both nights this year. It's a fun event. It's like an arts movie, series of movies, small short films about fishing, not just trout fishing, but fishing around the world, and conservation are some of the topics. And there's some funny stuff, too. You can come out. You can see fly tires this year. We'll have three fly tires. Jerry Haddon from the Upper Delaware is tying, Scott Cesari from Bangor, and George's last name is
Masek
from he runs a fly tying class at LL Bean. He's going to be there showing people how to tie the Lehigh River Killer.
Might also have the gentleman from, if people are familiar with the YouTube videos from Tight Lines Fly Fishing, we're working on lining him up to do a fly tying demo too. Back to your original question there, Steve. This was really born out of a relationship that we forged with Arts Quest before we even started thinking about doing the fly fishing film tour. Arts Quest brought in a film, more of a like an independent piece that was called Kiss the Water. And they approached Mark Demko from Arts Quest, approached Trout Unlimited to sort of help cross promote that film because he thought we would be interested in it and thought it would be a good relationship to build. So when we decided to pursue the fly fishing film tour, we gave Mark a call at ArtsQuest and said, what do you think about this? Can we partner with ArtsQuest and try to make this a success? And they were on board right away. They got behind it. They said, yes, let's do this. And we created a really, really successful partnership with them. And it's one we're hoping to do every year. I mean, yeah, we're up to two nights, like we said, and you know, we might just go from there.
And each year we've tried to expand it a little. And we really are fortunate to have the venue at ArtsQuest at the Banco Ale House Cinema. It's perfect. It has ample seating. It's comfortable. And some of the marketing of this, ArtsQuest has been very helpful in getting the word out. And it's a great partnership.
It's fantastic. People are encouraged to arrive at 6 p.m. We have, I hesitate to call it a cocktail hour, but that's what it is.
You got to buy your own, though.
Yes.
We're not treating you.
There will be the
Mike and Ike's Bistro.
Mike and Ike's Bistro. There will be food available for purchase, and also there will be a bar that's open. Kind of a cool thing a lot of people like about the Frank Banco Ale House Cinema is that you can actually take your beer into the cinema with you, which, you know, is kind of always a neat thing. You don't have to finish your beer before you go in. So people are encouraged to arrive at 6 p.m. for, you know, sort of a social hour. Check out some fly tying demonstrations. Talked with people about Trout Unlimited.
We're also going to have some raffles. We're going to raffle off some drift boat trips. In the past, we've had Bighorn Anglers. Steve Galetta raffled a trip with us last year. This year, we have a trip on the Missoula area with Russell Parks. And Jerry Haddon from the Upper Delaware is giving us two drift boat trips to raffle off. So there's an opportunity to get out there and go fishing if you win on the raffle. I think we might have some fishing equipment to raffle off. And then just for showing up, we have some stuff to give away.
Yeah, we always have door prizes every year, free door prizes. Don't have to spend anything to get those.
Yeah, we'll give you a door prize ticket for free.
Right.
The fly demonstrations take place
in the social hour before the movie.
Outside the theater.
Outside the theater.
There's a great lobby there. Just, you know, and the last 2 years, we've packed it with 200 people. Before the event started.
Yeah. Rumor has it there might even be a drift boat in there this year, but we're not really sure.
And the proceeds
help us with conservation issues. The proceeds help us with sending folks to the river conservation if we have a student.
All those programs
that we've talked about, we can help see them go forward, and helps our chapter put on presentations that we want to do in the community.
Right, and then the part of the proceeds will go to ArtsQuest too. They share in the proceeds on that too for their educational arts fund.
So it sounds like a great partnership. And just to talk about the tickets, $15 in advance, $20 at the gate.
At the gate, get them early. That's all I could tell you.
Right,
don't wait. Save the $5 and get them early.
Last year we sold out before the day of the event, so everyone who was, you know, waiting to see if they wanted to go, or maybe thought I'll just go down and get a ticket when I get there, we had to turn them away. It was unfortunate, and I think we had over 70 people we turned away. So the tickets are available through the Steel Stacks website, www.steelstacks.org. You can click on there, and you can find the event under the cinema page. You can also go to the Monocacy chapter website, which is www.monocacytu.org, and you'll see links to it there and the information about it and information about all of our upcoming events.
Or you can go in person, and they wait on you at the ticket booth. It's really very nice. I did that today. Yep. I got my tickets already.
Well, thank you. I got mine, too. I hope to see you there, then.
I'll see you Wednesday night, man.
I didn't want to be there, and you wouldn't be there.
I'll be there.
Folks can also call 610-332-3378 to get tickets as well.
Steve, thanks for having us. We really enjoyed this. You were afraid you couldn't fill an hour. We're ready to keep talking.
Well, how can folks join your chapter?
Go to our website,
monocacytu.org.
There's a link there. We would love to have you if you're listening and you're not a member of TU. We'd like to find out more. You don't even have to be a member to come to our meeting and see what we're all about. And we would welcome you. We got a nice group of folks. What's our program coming up in March?
Well, it's the Fly Fishing Film Tour.
Oh, it's the film tour. In April, we'll have another program.
In April is our Bugs and Dogs event, which will be on the banks of the Monocacy Creek at Illick's Mill Park, and it's a hot dog cookout.
Bring your family.
Family cookout night. We do a little fishing sometimes if the mood strikes us. Mostly we just socialize and tell fish stories.
We tell a lot of fish stories, and they're all true.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Ed Hart, and Eric Brozik from the Monocacy chapter of Trout Unlimited for joining us tonight on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Quite an interesting discussion of fly fishing and conservation and the event coming up at Steelstacks on March 28th and 29th. Thank you for listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY Allentown, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org, serving the Lehigh Valley. We are the Lehigh Valley's community NPR station and your source for NPR news, public affairs, and a great mix of hand-picked music. I know it's true because Rick Weaver has brought a nice, neat stack of wonderful Celtic music for you to enjoy just for you. It's currently 59 degrees, headed down to 32 overnight. Rain and snow likely overnight, and snow likely Friday morning. It's 7:01, time for news headlines from NPR and then Celtic Fair.
Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Even as two House committees have approved portions of the Republicans' new health care bill, another major industry group has come out against the proposal. Today, AARP, the nation's largest advocacy group for older Americans, said it opposes the measure. David Certner is the group's legislative counsel.
It institutes age rating, which allows insurance companies